Last time we spoke about the Battle of Kohima and the mop-up of the Admiralty Islands. The battle for Kohima led to battles raging over the Kohima Ridge. At one point, only 2,500 Allied defenders were facing nearly 15,000 Japanese. Numerous features fell to the Japanese atop Kohima Ridge. The Japanese were taking heavy casualties while pushing the defenders closer and closer to the town of Kohima. Then a decisive moment presented itself. The Japanese had an open shot against Imapur. However, mostly because of animosity towards General Mudaguchi, the chance to deliver a killing blow was all but lost. If Imapur had been taken, it may have changed the entire Burma War. Over in the Admiralty Islands, Los Negros and Manas were finally all mopped up, and now the Allies had forward airfields to further smash the inner Japanese defensive perimeter. General Douglas MacArthur's triumphant return to the Philippines was well on its way. This episode is The Defense of India. Welcome back to the Pacific War Podcast Week by Week, and I'm your dutiful host, Craig Watson. Before we begin, I just want to remind you all that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Perhaps you want to learn a bit more about World War II? Kings and Generals has an assortment of episodes on World War II, and so much more, so go give them a look over at YouTube. So please, subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, The Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that, you're still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, the Pacific War Channel over at YouTube. Over there, I just released part 3 of my series on the invasion of Manchuria, Operation Jinzhou. Also, please check out my Patreon account at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel, where I have exclusive podcasts. Over there, a recent poll just concluded, and it looks like the next podcast is going to be on the weird battle of Castle Itter. For those who don't know, that is when Americans and Wehrmacht fought off the SS. You heard that correctly. So be sure to check it out. Last we spoke, General Mudaguchi had initiated a grand offensive against Kohima. General Slim knew the seizure of Kohima would be attempted only in conjunction with the seizure of the much more important target, Dimapur. It was at Dimapur where an enormous Allied supply dump lied over the Lido-Imphal line. It was the hub for which all Allied activity in the region revolved. If Dimapur were to fall, the province of Manipur would be impossible to defend, and the Brahmaputra Valley would be interdicted, thus cutting off the overland supply to China. To everybody's shock, the Japanese instead invested an entire division to attack Kohima. General Slim thought it was an enormous blunder on the part of General Seto Kotoku, going as far as to ask the RAF not to bomb the general's HQ, as quote, "It never struck him that he could inflict terrible damage on us without taking Kohima at all." In truth, it was not really Seto at fault here. It was more so upon his superior, General Kawabe Masakazu, who did not trust nor like Mudaguchi at all, and rightfully suspected the man's megalomaniac plan to invade India. This man was basically what you would call a sandbagger. And as I used to say when I played ADC in League of Legends, and a jungler was feeding the enemy, intentionally, you know, there's nothing worse than a sandbagger. For people who understand that statement, good on you. This Mudaguchi's Operation Yugo, the intended invasion of India, saw the 33rd and 15th Divisions closing in on Imphal by the end of March, as the 31st Division attacked Kohima. General Cohen's 17th Division was able to effectively retreat to Imphal by April the 4th, with the 49th Brigade acting as a rearguard. Meanwhile, General Yanagida had been replenished with ammunition and provisions after the Battle of Tonzang, and now ordered the 214th and 215th Regiments to resume their advance. Colonel Sasahara Masahiko's 215th Regiment departed Singhel on March the 27th and crossed the India-Burma border by April the 3rd. They advanced to Chudachampur by the 7th, as the 214th followed closely behind them. Meanwhile, the right assault unit, the Yamamoto unit, had been in hot pursuit of General Gracie's 20th Division since the start of April, and the 3rd Battalion, 213th Regiment of the Mitsue Unit had been capturing the town of Chamal. Additionally, the 1st Battalion, 60th Regiment attempted but failed to break through the Lacheng Hill in late March. Afterwards, the unit was ordered to turn back and to attempt a development of Gracie's left flank by moving through Lemlong and then the Kampang in early April. To the north, General Yamachi's divisional headquarters advanced to Kasom on March 28th. Yamachi ordered two companies of the 1st Battalion, 67th Infantry to attack and occupy Kameng, which presented an easy approach to Imphal. The 123rd Brigade of the 5th Indian Division had closed the gap with barbed wire and set up defensive positions in the hills to the immediate north and south of the road. The attack was made on the night of April the 3rd against the positions held by the 1 and 17th Dogras of the 123rd Indian Brigade on a hill off the Okhul Road, just south of the village of Kameng, but it failed to achieve its objective. They were then furiously counterattacked by the guns of the 28th Field Regiment and by Dogras itself. A troop of tanks, each of the 3rd Carabiniers and the 7th Cavalry, were also positioned on either side of the hill, and they fired upon what were easy targets. By the next morning, almost 100 Japanese bodies were found. The few survivors had withdrawn. It is believed that the ultimate objective of this attack had been the Fairweather Kangla Airfield just further south. It was now felt that the 15th Division's strength was spread far too thinly, thus the Japanese believed their detachments holding along the Imphal-Ukhrul Road were badly in need of reinforcements. As such, Yamachi ordered the 60th and 51st Regiments to get into closer contact, and by the 4th of April, they were moving into position just due north of Imphal. On that same day, Colonel Matsumura started moving down the road to seize a supply depot known as 221, Advanced Ordnance Depot, the largest in the Imphal area just north of Kanglotongbi. As the Japanese pressure on the road increased, its men and some of the most valuable supplies, including ammunition and explosives, were moved into a defensive area at Kanglotongbi known as the Lion Box. The 2nd Battalion managed to take Hill 3813 by April the 6th, but the 3rd Battalion was less fortunate facing the Lion Box. The Lion Box had very few fighting troops amongst the several thousand men within its perimeter. The box was defended against mounting Japanese assaults from the 4th to the 7th of April, while the evacuation of supplies to Imphal continued apace. Its defense was assisted by units of the 9th Indian Brigade and tanks of the 3rd Carabiniers, who had traveled up from Sekmai in the south during the day. On the 5th, while the 9th Indian Brigade and the tanks of the 3rd Carabiniers were patrolling forward to help out the Lion Box, Cohen's 63rd Brigade arrived to Sekmai to reinforce the northern defenses, and this in turn allowed the 9th Brigade to take up a position to defend Nukshimgum. On the 6th, Colonel Omoto's 3rd Battalion attacked Nukshimgum's northern hill, known as Hill 3833, successfully overrunning the hastily developed Indian defenses there, while the 1st Battalion marched upon Hill 4057. There was a heroic counterattack by a platoon, led by 18-year-old Jemadar Abdul Hafiz, serving as a Nab Subedar, junior commissioned officer in the 9th Jat Regiment, British Indian Army. His platoon managed to recover Hill 3833 by the end of the day. Jemadar was tasked with recovering it with two sections of his platoon. He fearlessly led the way and recovered the feature in the face of a hail of machine gun fire and grenade attacks, killing several Japanese in the process. Injured by now, Jemadar continued his attack, fighting to his death, and was posthumously awarded the Victoria Cross. The hill would become known as the Runaway Hill because of the way the Japanese had fled from Jemadar's brave attacks. April the 7th saw a follow-up charge with Omoto's 3rd Battalion re-seizing the hills around Nukshimgum. In the 4 days that followed, Nukshimgum exchanged hands a couple of times. The 3rd Company 9th Battalion Jats recovered it, only to lose it again to the Japanese 3rd Company 51st Battalion by April the 11th, who dug in well on its northern and southern bumps around Nukshimgum. Meanwhile, Matsumura was continuing to exert heavy pressure upon the Lion Box, finally forcing the battle's weary defenders to evacuate the box as the position became impossible to defend. The valiant efforts of the Lion Box defenders had earned the British Indian troops valuable time to evacuate a large amount of critical supplies back to Imphal, preventing their use to the Japanese. And do remember, Mutaguchi literally planned for this entire offensive to rely upon seizing the Allied supply depots as their logistical supply line. That is what we call a very bold strategy. Matsumura's troops had suffered heavy casualties in their efforts against the Lion Box. Now he ordered the 60th Regiment to go east to reassemble around the villages of Tingsat, Molvom, and the surrounding heights by April the 8th. they would be reinforced by the Honda raiding units coming in from the north. On the 9th, Omoto's 1st Battalion assaulted Hill 4057, taking it from elements of the 123rd Indian Brigade, as the 3rd Battalion secured Nungshin Gum. This breakthrough posed an unacceptable threat to the British, leaving the 4th Corps HQ, the Imphal Main, and Kangla airfields vulnerable to further Japanese attacks. This prompted General Briggs to get forces together to evict the Japanese from the recently gained heights. Briggs was reinforced with the 254th Indian Tank Brigade's armor for the job. An unrelenting artillery and aerial bombardment began against the 51st Regiment, greatly reducing the strength of Omoto's companies. Suffering such horrific losses, Omoto was forced to retreat over the eastern side of the Iril River. At around dusk on the 12th, Omoto's 3rd Battalion withdrew from Nungshin Gum to take up better positions in the hills north of Hill 4057. From this position, the 3rd Battalion was able to cover the 1st Battalion's withdrawal from Hill 4057 during the night. Simultaneously, Briggs launched his main counteroffensive, tossing two companies of the 117th Dogras and the B Squadron of the 3rd Carabiniers. That morning, the infantry and tanks began climbing up via two spurs on the southeastern side of Nungshin Gum. On each spur was a troop of M3 Lee Grant tanks, together with a company of Dogras. Their divisional artillery, together with another troop of tanks, had been placed east and west of Nungshin Gum on this plain. As infantry and armor climbed, Vengeance dive bombers and Hurricanes bombed and strafed the peaks. Soon thereafter, 88 pieces of artillery and tanks on the plain plastered the entire area. The two groups of infantry and tanks joined up at the peak named Pyramid, and they proceeded in a single file up a narrow ridge towards the Japanese on the southern bump. As they approached the Japanese defenses, fierce fighting erupted. The tanks were sprayed with machine gun and rifle fire, and grenades were thrown against them as well. But there was only so much the Japanese could do. The use of armor on Nungshin Gum, which rose over 1,000 feet above the valley floor, was a masterstroke. The Japanese had simply never expected to encounter tanks at such an area, and they had nothing to counter them with effectively. The British had to pay a high price as well, though. All of the British tank officers were killed, and numerous infantry officers were wounded that day. The former had been shot as they struck their heads out of their tanks' turrets to guide them safely over the narrow and steep ridgelines. Then it was finally left to the VCO of the Dogras, Subedar Rambir Singh, and Squadron Sergeant Major Craddock of the 3rd Carabiniers to complete the battle. They rose to the occasion. The tanks finally destroyed the main bunkers as the infantry charged and killed any of the survivors. There were casualties on both sides, but the Japanese losses were especially high, leaving about 250 bodies at the scene. This was the closest the Japanese would come to Imphal as a large organized force in 1944. Yamachi's 15th Division would never be able to pose such an urgent threat from the north ever again. On April the 13th, the Honda unit and the 2nd Battalion, 60th Regiment, launched an unsuccessful attack against Chiang Mai. In another attack on the 18th, the 2nd Battalion gained a foothold in the enemy positions on the eastern hill of Chiang Mai, but would be forced off quickly, losing about 150 men. The failure to breach the defenders at Chiang Mai marked a turning point in the operation, forcing the right assault unit onto the defensive. Meanwhile, Omoto's withdrawal had opened up a gap between his units and Matsumura's, leaving Matsumura isolated around the Imphal Kohima Road and the Mapua Mofom Range. This also left Matsumura's supply lines increasingly vulnerable to attacks by Briggs' 5th Division. General Schoons ordered the 23rd Indian Division to push back on the Imkro Road to regain control over the area, while Briggs cleared the Japanese out of the Imphal Kohima and Mapua Mofom Range. For this task, Major General Orvie Roberts dispatched the 37th Brigade up the Ukro Road, while the 1st Brigade made a wide flanking maneuver to the right to swing north in an attempt to capture Yamachi's HQ. A composite unit of the 51st Regiment, known as the Tsuchida Unit, formed out of two companies of Tsuchida's HQ, managed to resist the Indian attacks at Yangang Popkpi. Their mission was to hold the pass near Hill 3524, and they were met by numerous enemy counterattacking groups. The Tsuchida unit was faced with a serious crisis when it was attacked by a strong enemy tank force on April the 18th. Meanwhile, back on the 15th, the sudden appearance of the 1st Brigade at Hill 5515, with its headquarters threatened by this new enemy maneuver, Yamachi decided to move the 15th Divisional HQ and the Tsuchida unit to the rear of the right and center assault units. This move was complicated in that it entailed the evacuation of a large number of casualties, among whom was one General Yamachi himself. Upon arriving in the vicinity of Nonga, intense enemy activity was encountered. It was found impossible to move west to the desired destination, and the headquarters was forced to move towards Longsheng via Urkrel. The Sizuda unit troops reverted to their parent organizations. The command post of the division was finally established at a point about 3 miles southwest of Longsheng on the 29th of April. By April the 22nd, Roberts' brigades made contact with the Urkrel Road near Litan and began hunting down Yamachi's HQ. They searched for it around Shangfel to the north. They converged on a spot only to find Yamachi was not there. Over to the east, the 9th Brigade attacked the Mapua-Mofum Range on the 23rd, making some initial gains against Mapua. Their field guns with hurricane bombers smashed Mapua, allowing the Jats and Punjabis to fight their way up and capture it within 2 days. But further to the north, the heights around Mofum were better defended and the Japanese defied attempts to infiltrate their positions. The brigade soon got bogged down. And further east, the 123rd Brigade advanced up the Iro River Valley, facing some of Momoto's retreating men, and they would reach Sangmai by mid-May. The Japanese at this point were also preparing to continue their offensive further south. General Yanagida received reports of the progress of the 15th Division and that Kohima had already fallen, apparently. So he decided to bypass the expected resistance in the Morang vicinity and to advance directly upon Imphal. This prompted Colonel Sasagara to send his 2nd Battalions of the 215th and 213th Regiments to attack the Torbung positions on the 9th. They managed to successfully outflank the 49th Brigade and exert so much pressure on the area, the 49th Brigade were forced to withdraw over the next few days. With the Japanese in hot pursuit, Cohen dispatched the 32nd Indian Brigade to defend the Tidium Road, and for Brigadier David McKenzie to shift his main position further back to Bishanpur. The Bishanpur village was very well located. It was where the hills touched the Tidum Road to the west, and to the east lay the upper reaches of the Loktak Lake. Bishanpur was considered the best place to position a defense on the southwestern approach to Imphal. It was also important because from here, the track wriggled west over the mountains to the Silchar in Assam. Besides the Imphal-Kohima Road, the Bishanpur-Silchar track was the only navigable route back to the rest of India. Unsurprisingly then, it was also of interest to the Japanese. On April the 12th, the Japanese attacked Patsangbam. But the 2nd Battalion, 213th Regiment, was held up by heavy artillery and aerial bombardment from Bishanpur. The Japanese forayed into the villages of Kwai Simphai and Khoi Juman to the northeast, but they were rebuffed. To counter them, aerial bombardments were called in upon Patsangbam and against the next large village, Ningthokong. Strategic Air Force liberators pattern-bombed the two villages with 1,000-pound bombs. The British sent tanks, together with infantry units across the paddy fields towards Patsangbam, but their advance was held up by fierce opposition. Unlike at Nungshingum, the Japanese here were armed with anti-tank guns. Evicting them would require much more effort. The 4th Independent Engineer Regiment was brought up to reinforce the 2nd Battalion, 213th Infantry, at Patsangbam on April the 20th, but it would be unable to break through nonetheless. Over to the west, Sasahara's men tried to break through Kokadan on the 14th. They made repeated attacks for over a month, but they would be unable to penetrate Mackenzie's defenses. The 214th Regiment tossed 3 attacks against Hill 5846 from their position on Inguruk by April the 24th. Hand-to-hand fighting ensued as each side sought to gain possession of these hills. The British had brought up a troop of Lee Grant tanks of the 150th Regiment Royal Armored Corps from Bishanpur, and these were pressed into battle, firing within close support of their infantry. By April the 26th, Point 5846 and the Wooded Ridge area were under their firm control, while the Japanese had Wireless Hill. Meanwhile, the 2nd Battalion reinforced the 214th Regiment to skirt around Hill 5846 from the west, going just due north of the track. This endeavor ultimately failed in the end, and the men would have to turn back by the end of the month. Due to his failures and disagreements, General Muraguchi consequently lost faith in Yanagida, who was ignored from this point onwards while his chief of staff, Colonel Tanaka Tetsujiro, effectively commanded the 33rd Division. Meanwhile, over on the hill of the Shinam Saddle, the battle for Nippon Hill had been raging since early April. Gracie's initial piecemeal attempts to retake the feature only saw his men fail. Over on the other side, the Yamato detachment launched a general attack from Chamol on the 8th, trying to make a breakthrough to Nippon Hill, to relieve the outnumbered 11th Company, 213th Regiment. While the Japanese were held up by crossfire from Tengnumpal, the 80th Brigade sent three companies of the 1st Devons to recapture Nippon Hill on the 11th. Following heavy artillery and aerial bombardment, the British troops stormed the hill with a fierce lobbing of grenades and machine gun fire, seizing the feature by the end of the day. Nevertheless, General Yamamoto had his men commit more and more continuous attacks over the next few days. What was witnessed on Nippon Hill was to be repeated on many occasions around Impal. Japanese defensive positions would be subjected to intense bombardments, which it was hard to imagine anyone could survive. And yet, time and time again, the Japanese would emerge out of the targeted positions to counterattack. In fact, Nippon Hill was one such place where, even days after it had been recaptured by the British, a lone Japanese soldier would emerge from the rubble and attack them. This after being buried for hours or even days, usually without recourse or food or water. This behavior was a measure of the extraordinary capabilities of the Japanese, as defenders in particular, and of their dedication to the cause in general. It was also a testament to the strength of their defenses. On features like Nippon Hill, the Japanese had shown themselves to be adept at digging an extensive, deep network of underground tunnels and holes within their positions. These allowed them to withstand bombardments, while the small openings allowed for sustained fire to be kept up against anyone who approached. After a week of fighting, the 3rd Battalion, 213th Regiment, finally recaptured Nippon Hill on April the 16th, and this time it was to stay with the Japanese until the end of July. The hill would allow the Japanese to observe Allied movements over the Shinam Saddle and the road below, so accurate firing with well-sighted guns on this hill and the adjacent ridge would cause many casualties amongst the defenders. Yamamoto ramped up his efforts trying to break through towards Impal. With additional tanks and artillery support, the 3rd Battalion, 213th Regiment managed to overrun Crete East on the 22nd, as the 80th Brigade evacuated to the isolated Cyprus. Pressing onwards, Yamamoto attacked Crete West, tossing multiple attacks at the feature over the next few days. Despite the ferocity of the invaders, the defenders would manage to hold on until the end of April. Meanwhile, the 1st Battalion, 60th Regiment, was unable to break through Hill 5240 near Kampang, so on the 20th, they were redirected to hit the northern sector of Pelel. The battalion had suffered 300 casualties, unable to pose much of a threat any longer to Gracie's men. Now over to their left was the 1st INA's division, the 2nd Gandhi Brigade, deployed on the left flank of the Yamamoto force and the initial group that had rushed over through the hills towards Pelel. They were targeting the airfield from the south in coordination with the Japanese, closing in via Langal from the east. They clashed with Indian and Gurkha defenders at the Purim Chamban on May the 2nd. Now there are differing accounts of what exactly happened during the Battle of Purim Chamban. One story has it the INA group reached very close to the airfield, while another has it they reached some 8 kilometers short of it. What is common in both stories, however, is the reaction of the 14th Army units, who happen to be Indian and Gurkha, to the INA's efforts. A parley between the two is supposed to have taken place at some point during the battle, where the latter tried to convince their brethren on the British side not to fight. This was rejected, the INA attacked, and then was repulsed. At least 50 INA men were killed in their retaliatory response. It has been argued that these attacks by their fellow Indians affected INA morale. They had not expected to be considered traitors by their former comrades of the Indian Army. Several hundred INA men deserted before the end of the battle, although the majority of the force remained in the hills around the Temu-Pelel Road, wrecked by disease and hunger. In the meantime, the Kohima garrison received relief on their ridge positions, allowing General Grover to formulate a plan to recapture lost territory in Kohima and to annihilate the 31st Division. His plan was to hold Zubza and Perafima in the rear while Brigadier John Chaplin's 6th Brigade would launch an attack against the Japanese center and gradually push them towards the southern and southwestern flanks of the Kohima Ridge. Brigadier Victor Hawkins' 5th Brigade would also perform a flanking maneuver to the north while Brigadier William Gottschen's 4th Brigade did the same in the south. On April the 18th, Hawkins thus dispatched his first units across the deep Zubza Nullah to the Marima Ridge to cut the Kohima-Marima-Bukajan Road, with the rest of the brigade following in an excruciating march and finally assembling at the Marima Ridge by April the 27th. Further to the north, in parallel to the 2nd Division's advance, Brigadier Perone's men had been performing an extremely difficult march into the Naga Hills. Their task was to prevent the Japanese from escaping the Brahmaputra Valley taking a track leading from Marima to Bocajan. For weeks, the Chindit Brigade had conducted an effective operation, ambushing Japanese supply routes, denying them territory, encouraging local Naga resistance efforts, and causing just general havoc. General Muraguchi had ordered Sato to send his 124th Regiment to support the struggling 15th Division in the south. Sato decided to occupy Garrison Hill prior to complying with Mutaguchi's directive, immediately sending the 1st Battalion, 138th Regiment, to support the attacks of the 58th Regiment. The assault failed on the 23rd, and this further convinced Sato he would be unable to hold Kohima if he sent the reinforcements Mutaguchi requested. His decision was also heavily influenced by his increasing anger at his superior, as Mutaguchi was completely failing to supply his men. He had been promised at least 250 tons of supplies to arrive by April the 8th. Sato testily demanded food and ammunition. In fact, there had been very few supplies that ever reached the 31st Division from Burma, the men having to survive on what they had brought with them, what they could beg or steal from Naga villages, or what they called Churchill rations that they could capture from the British stockpiles. Sato's fury at the lack of promised supplies reaching Kohima was fueled by his belief that the 31st Division was being let down by Mutaguchi's abject failure to break into Imphal. In response to Mutaguchi's demand that he send troops to assist the Imphal battle, on April the 20th, Sato sent the first of a number of increasingly tense signals to the army commander. "We captured Kohima in 3 weeks as promised. How about Imphal?" Mutaguchi's response to this: "Probable date for capture of Imphal is April the 29th. April the 29th, by the way, happened to be Emperor Hirohito's birthday. Sato plainly did not believe him. On April the 30th, Sato signaled him again: "31st Division, at the limit of its endurance. When are you going to destroy Imphal?" And to this signal, he received no answer. The relationship between Sato and Mutaguchi had never been good, but now it was really bad. Over the next 2 weeks, the battles of Kohima Ridge were not seeing any results. Repeated attacks were made against Garrison Hill, as Chaplin's men tossed desperate attacks at the extreme northern edge of the ridge, allowing for a troop of Lee Grant tanks to lumber up the western end of Naga Hill in order to provide armored support for the 5th Brigade. The plan to get the tanks onto the back of Naga Hill by driving through the Japanese positions overlooking the TCP finally succeeded on April the 27th. The Lee Grant tanks struggling along the track, wary of some mines, but taking the Japanese entirely by surprise at this stroke of legerdemain. Peppered on all sides futilely by bullets, they joined the 5th Brigade on Naga Hill, albeit at the cost of 28 Dorset dead, who had kept intense pressure on the TCP end of the Kohima Ridge to distract the Japanese during the entire operation. In the fighting for control over the tennis court, no means of overcoming Japanese bunkers could be discovered using infantry alone. And attempts were made to bulldoze a path up to the remains of the deputy commissioner's bungalow to allow for some Lee Grant tanks to move onto the tennis court and engage the bunkers directly with their 75mm guns. Unhappily, the first effort failed when the Lee Grant tank went into reverse, pulling the bulldozer to which it was attached back down the steep slope in a heap of crashing, twisted metal. 4 days later, a similar attempt was made with a Stuart light tank of the 45th Indian Light Cavalry, but it also failed, as the Japanese had brought up a 3.7-inch anti-tank gun and put the tank out of action, fortunately with no loss to the crew. By the 27th, the tanks made a breakthrough to the Naga Hill, though. The Japanese had suffered terrible casualties, causing them to suspend operations against Garrison Hill. And this would cause the 31st Division to fully adopt a defensive stance. Meanwhile, Goshen's men had been sent out on a long march to cut the Imphal Road below the Arudura Spur on the night of the 25th. They were advancing through some of the very worst terrain of the entire region. It was deep, nearly vertical jungle-covered gullies falling between Mount Pulibadzu and at the face of Mount Japfu. The 4th Brigade would reach the valley between Pulibadzu and Japfu in 3 days. Once there, General Stauffer ordered Goshen to climb over the Pulibadzu Ridge, then come down into Kohima to hit the Japanese position on the GPT Ridge, which at the time were giving very serious problems to Chaplin's men. The brigade accordingly turned left, climbed up and over the Pulibadzu Ridge, and began to slowly descend through the jungle down into the Kohima side. A prominent pimple above the GPT Ridge, known as Oaks Hill, sitting about 6,000 feet, was occupied by the Norfolks and the 143rd Company on May the 1st, The presence of British troops 1,500 feet above the Japanese positions became known to them for the first time. But that is all for India today, as there is something else cooking up in the CBI theater that we need to talk about. Since early 1943, the United States had steadily increased its air force in China. By the beginning of 1944, there were more than 500 U.S. planes in the area, whereas in spite of the organization of the 5th Air Army, the Japanese Air Force had less than half this number of planes in China. Furthermore, with the war situation rapidly growing worse in the Pacific, the Japanese Air Force in China could not hope for any replenishment. Enemy planes not only interfered with the Japanese ground operations, but they also harassed the lines of communication and attacked the occupied areas. General Chenault's 14th Air Force had been causing such problems that the Japanese were forced to act now. The catalyst for their future action was actually because of a raid against Formosa, carried out by 14 B-25s, 8 P-38s, and 8 P-51s on November the 25th of 1943. This caught the Japanese by complete surprise, as the Chinese-American aircraft strafed and dropped bombs over the Shinchiku airfield, successfully destroying its installations along with 42 planes on the ground at the cost of just 3 fighters lost. This prompted the Japanese commanders to target strategic points along the Hunan-Guangxi, Guangzhou-Hankou, and southern Beijing-Hankou railways. Thus, the infamous Operation Ichigo was born. Now, Ichigo's primary targets were Guilin and Liuzhou's airfields, where the U.S. was developing bases for B-29s to launch strikes against the Japanese home islands. And might I say this, if you're interested in a more in-depth talk about this subject, over at the Pacific War Channel on YouTube, or you can just check out the podcast version on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, it's at the Pacific War Channel, I did an interview with David from the Cold War Channel. And the subject was the bombing of the Japanese home islands. But we talked about the very subject we're about to jump into right now. Basically, the very beginning of operations against the Japanese home islands did not begin in the Pacific. It was actually within air bases in China. And it took quite a long time. It started in India, and then it gradually kept moving east. Anyways, Dave is very, very knowledgeable about the air campaign. It's actually a passion of his. It was one of the very best podcasts I've ever done. So please go check it out. It's a really good one. Now, in general, the main objectives were to link the railways in Beijing and Hankou in northern China to the southern Chinese coast in Guangzhou. This would spare shipping and avoid pesky American submarine forces who were now running havoc. It was also to take out airfields in Sichuan and Guangxi provinces to thwart further U.S. bombing of Formosa and the Japanese home islands. This also, in turn, would open a land route to Indochina and hopefully would destroy enough NRA units to collapse Chiang Kai-shek's government, finally solving the China problem altogether. Ichigo would start in late April with an offensive by the 12th Army of Lieutenant General Kita Soichi, later replaced by Lieutenant General Uchiyama Eitaro. This was codenamed Operation Gogo, tasked with capturing the areas along the southern Beijing-Hankou Railway, centered around Jiangzhou and Liaoyang, and destroying the main strength of the 1st War Area Army. Then in early June, the 11th Army of General Yokoyama would launch Operation Togo, with the objective of capturing Changsha and Hangyang and destroying the main force of the 6th and 9th War Area Armies. Following the conclusion of the first phase, later in July, the 11th Army would be assisted by the 23rd Army of Lieutenant General Tanaka Hiseichi and the Indochina Garrison Army of Lieutenant General Viscount Machichi Kazimoto, who would capture Guilin and Liuzhou and then would destroy the 4th War Area Army. Finally, the third phase of Operation Togo would see the 23rd Army capture the strategic areas along the southern Guangzhou-Hankou Railway, centered around Nanning, by destroying the 7th War Area Army in September, while the 11th Army continued its advance south towards the Sichuan Airfield to link up with the Indochinese forces. For the entire operation, the 5th Air Army of Lieutenant General Shimoyama Takuma would support the offensive from the skies, tasked with annihilating the American-Chinese air forces and attaining air supremacy over China. The logistics of Operation Ichigo constituted one of the most incredible examples of the IJA's offensive preparations. Between some of the measures taken was the emplacement of dozens of anti-air batteries throughout the Yangtze River area to limit the Chinese-American air activity against troop concentrations on the Southern Channel. the transfer of dozens of thousands of troops by railway without interference from Chinese guerrillas because security at the railway lines was increased, the monthly river transport of 40,000 tons of supplies, the secret storage of 600 pontoons, and the construction of hideouts for munition arsenals that should last them about 2 years, and hundreds of deposits that harbored 50 million liters of gasoline that should last them about 8 months. 40 million for land vehicles, 10 million for planes. Basically, throughout this entire series, we kind of make fun of the Japanese logistical capabilities. This is one time where they really impress us. By early April, General Hatta had amassed 62,000 men, 52,000 of which were Japanese, and 10,000 were collaborationist units alongside 800 tanks, 1,550 artillery pieces, 250 aircraft, and 15,550 motorized vehicles with another 100,000 horses. And while those numbers seem pretty incredible, by the late half of Ichigo, it'll be 500,000 Japanese. This is an unprecedented operation. Meanwhile, the British Eastern Fleet had been receiving more naval resources due to successes in the Mediterranean and in Northern Europe, so they can now carry out more aggressive actions in the Indian and Pacific Oceans. Agreements had been reached after objections from Admiral Ernest King, but now procedures would need to be learnt by naval crews and the Fleet Air Arm air crews. To this end, Operation Diplomat, a training exercise, took place in late March of 1944. The objective was for the fleet to rendezvous with a group of tankers escorted by Dutch cruiser HNLMS Tromp, and they were going to practice refueling at sea. The ship's rendezvous with the USN Task Force 58.5 built around the aircraft carrier USS Saratoga and three destroyers. To further support the coming Hollandia and Aitape landings, Admiral King requested that, during April, the Eastern Fleet should engage Japanese forces in the area and hold them there to reduce the opposition that could be encountered by Americans at Western New Guinea. In response, Admiral Somerville launched Operation Cockpit on April the 16th. It was an air attack against Sabang off Sumatra. The fleet sailed from Chequalame on April the 16th. 2 days later, the Gambia and Ceylon were detached from Task Force 69 to strengthen the anti-aircraft defenses of the carrier force. On the morning of the 19th, 17 Barracudas and 16 Corsairs from carriers Illustrious and 29 Dauntless and Avenger bombers with 24 Hellcats from Saratoga took off towards Sumatra, and then they caught the Japanese by complete surprise, finding no opposition there. 30 Japanese aircraft were destroyed on their airfields, and a direct hit from a 1,000-pound bomb blew up a large oil tank and set it on fire. Power station, barracks, and wireless station were also badly damaged. The submarine HMS Tactician reported large fires in the dockyards burning fiercely for hours after the fleet had left the area. The raid was a clear success, with Somerville later saying that the Japanese were, quote, "They had been caught with their kimonos up." I would like to take this time to remind all of you that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Please go subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, the Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that you're still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, the Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. Over there, I just released part 3 of my series on the Japanese invasion of Manchuria, Operation Jinzhou. Also, please check out my Patreon account at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel, where you can find exclusive podcasts. The last poll has concluded, and it was a tie, so I'm going to be doing 2 episodes over the course of probably 2 months. The first will be on the Battle of Castle Itter, a very peculiar battle that happened in 1945, where Americans and Germans fought the SS. You heard that right. The next podcast is going to be me explaining how the century of humiliation that China faced resulted in the People's Republic of China we see today. And yes, I will be saying a lot about the current administration under Xi Jinping. It will be quite a different episode. The invaders, it seems, bit off more than they could chew when they attacked India. General Muraguchi was facing a determined enemy, alongside very pissed off and somewhat insubordinate colleagues. Operation Ichigo was being prepared, and the Royal Navy was sending pretty large forces back into the Indian and Pacific Oceans, adding to the Aegean's misery.